ChatGPT and the like are big players in the field of knowledge transfer. Are they serious competitors in the field of science communication or just stochastic parrots? These are just some of the issues I'm going to discuss today with Mike Schaefer, professor of science communication. My name is Alexandra Jansky, leader of the innovation and digital education team at the University of Zurich. And this is Setting Sails, Navigating AI in Higher Education, a podcast about rethinking teaching to create better education for everyone, with or without AI. Mike, welcome to Setting Sails.
Happy to be here.
So maybe you want to share with us, when did you last use ChatGPT and for what?
I am using ChatGPT or other forms of generative AI also practically on a daily basis. So I've been using this half an hour ago for the last time when it was essentially about, we had a meeting this morning and we were discussing a couple of things and a colleague was having generative AI running on the site and having it summarize the meeting. And that was practically the first time that I had seen this, to be honest, and it was frighteningly accurate and good.
Yeah, I can imagine. I also used this like this before, and I also use ChatGPT a lot with the speech-to-text function. So I let my emails, for example, draft while I cook my dinner. So this is really, I think, also a very cool feature ChatGPT and other AI is giving us today. So maybe to make things a bit clearer for today's discussion, I'm not sure if everyone knows what exactly science communication is. Can you briefly describe what is science communication?
I think even the people who think they know what science communication is disagree about the exact understanding that they have. Science communication in general, certainly in my understanding, is the any kind of communication that is centered around science, scientific research, scientific results, scientific work. The production of that communication, the content of that communication, the uses of that communication, who's listening, who's reading, who's using that of some kind, and its effects. So does it lead to people learning things? Does it lead to people changing their attitudes? Does it lead to people changing their behaviors? That's all science communication. And if you understand it like that, which I do, then you have a rather broad understanding that includes things like individual scientists, when they explain their findings to non-scientific audiences. It includes also public relations by scientific organizations, universities, research institutions. It includes science journalism as well. It includes also science as it is being explained by generative AI, for example.
Very interesting. Also, like, maybe we talk about this a bit later when it comes to describing AI with science communication. Maybe let's think about the past. I know a time where scientists had to write their articles by their own, so about their research, they had to write the news. And I also know some scientists who are like, okay, I'm so happy that I don't have to do this anymore because I can write great research proposals. But when it comes to engage with people who are not into research, I really have a hard time. So nowadays, and that's I think is a good thing, almost every institute has at least one person in charge for communication or even a communication office. So how does science communication now in this kind of way work today? Has it changed?
Science communication has changed in many ways. One way is that it has changed in the perceived importance that it has. And for that, for example, the COVID-19 pandemic had something to do with that. After that, or during that, actually, many people realized, okay, it's important that we talk about science. It's important that many people understand what science is and does and how reliable it is and what it can say, but also where the limitations are of that also exist, of course. And that is something that many people in the public realized, but also decision makers, stakeholders, etc. So it's been perceived more important also within science, and it has changed in many ways. So one way is certainly that scientists nowadays have more options to actually do science communication, to engage in some way with society or with specific audiences, etc. they could always go into schools and give talks there. They could go to museums. They could do science cafes, etc. What they can do now for 15, 20 years is, of course, engage in social media, where the hurdles are very low. So it's very easy to do that, to get in there, to use Instagram or X, or rather Blue Sky, if we're talking about scientists and where they are nowadays. Mm-hmm. Or even the more, a bit more ambitious platforms like TikTok, if you like, or others. It's comparatively easy to do that, and you can do it yourself. You can do it bypassing gatekeepers. You don't have to go through the PR office of your university, which they sometimes don't like if you don't do that, but you can. And you don't have to go through journalists also. So that's an option for scientists individually. There's more opportunities to actually do that. There's, and you hinted at that, there's a high professionalization and intensification of organizational communication in science or about science. So if you look at universities and how university communication has developed over time, my university, our university, the University of Zurich, if you look back 20 years and how the communications office essentially of the university looked like, it was small and it was other people. And by now we have expanded and it's 25 people. And many of them are actually communications experts. They have some expertise in being journalists or in do social or something like that. So it has intensified, and they also do more. They do internal communication, external communication, the media, stakeholder, public relations, etc., even marketing now. So it has diversified there. A third dimension, I would say, is science journalism has changed considerably, and changed means it's in an economic crisis. Journalism as such is in an economic crisis, and specialized forms of journalism, like science journalism, are hit even harder because they're expensive, because you need a lot of expertise. You haven't had science journalism at all media houses anyway to begin with. And now it's going down and it's eroding a little bit, and it's getting, it's fewer and fewer people doing this and doing this on a high level. And that's a bit of a challenge, especially as university communication, organizational communication is becoming more important. The balance of power is shifting in a way. And the last thing is it has diversified. So there's more and more actors, speakers, voices being out there. There's politicians, there's organizations from civil society, there's movements like Fridays for Future, there's corporations, of course, pharmaceutical companies, etc. There's more and more players doing science communication, and that includes all kinds of science, all kinds of quality of science communication, if you like, from very reliable, high level, really good, all the way to dis and misinformation and really problematic content.
Mm-hmm. Let's discover this a bit, like this this diversity also of things, because I think we need to talk about like the opportunities ChatGPT is giving us, but also on, you already said it, the downfalls of AI in science communication. So maybe start with like the opportunities. I think one thing what made ChatGPT and other AI so successful is that it's very practical and very easy to access. So everyone basically can access ChatGPT. And I'm thinking when it comes to information, it gives me an answer. Do you think that this is an opportunity for people with fewer formal educational opportunities to further their learning? So to use AI in learning?
In general, yes. There's a lot of buts that we will probably get to in a second. But in general, yes. It's very similar to other digital media that we had. The entry level is rather low. You don't have to be that tech savvy to actually do it. So it's easy to use. You can ask questions in the language that you ask your questions to people around you, to your family, to your friends. Also, you get understandable answers. You can ask again. You can tell me, oh, look, I really didn't understand. Can you explain again? Or can you make this simpler? Or can you give me an example? And it does that. So in theory and in practice to some degree, it can really be an interesting first entry point for a lot of people to get information about science and about science in their real lives. I mean, many people encounter science around topics that really concern them, which can be health issues, but also nutrition, training, technology is an important entry point for people when they talk about science or science-related technical products, etc.
Yeah. So you already said it. It's like the good thing about ChatGPT is that it's not getting annoyed. You can ask like several times and you will always get a friendly answer, and you can even adjust complexity. So if you feel like, okay, that's too difficult for me to understand, please write it for a five-year-old and you will get a perfect answer for a five-year-old, and it would be great. So I'm just wondering, from all what you said, of course, if you have a very broad field of science communication, but will ChatGPT compete with science communication, or will it just be a tool helping science communication?
Prognoses are always difficult, especially when they concern the future. I don't know is probably the most correct answer that I can give, and that, to be fair, everybody probably could give at this stage. I think there's assessments like that. There's an AI for that. It's a page that you have online that, among other things, gives you the opportunity to check different professions for their potential to be replaced by AI. And if you look for the things, they don't have science communicator in there, but if you look for things that are similar or the most similar to science communicators, communication managers, communication experts, etc., the probability to be replaced by AI according to that site is very high. At the same time, there's a lot of buts surrounding generative AI. There's a lot of challenges. It will need humans in the loop. There are certain things that certainly can be replaced by AI. And we talked about this earlier with the example of minutes. Nobody likes doing minutes for meetings. And there it can really make a difference. And you have this in other aspects as well. So it can take some tedious jobs away. And at the same time, the question is, well, and that would be if I were to bet, I would bet my money on it won't replace science communicators. It will change the job of science communicators, and maybe significantly so, but it won't replace them. Science communicators will have to focus on other things, other aspects, but it will still need them.
So maybe one thing this could be, and this could be a way of like highlighting how important science communicators are. Many scholars describe ChatGPT as stochastic parrots. So like they can write something in a very coherent language, but they do not understand actually what it writes there. So there is no understanding of the context itself. But is it like that? Or do you think this will change with this thinking process now, for example, in Claude? Do you see there any opportunity in the future?
I'm probably know your boundaries. I'm not the right person to ask that question, really, because you would need an AI developer to properly answer that question, probably. So far, there's a lot of stochastic parrot to it, of course, which is it meant derogatory. But of course, the models that we have been using in the past 2 years are models that, based on vast amounts of digital training data and human training, approximate answers based on patterns that they have seen in the training data. And then you get stochastic answers. And in a way, it's stochastic parrots. I mean, the parrot thing, I'm not a fan of the parrot aspect of the stochastic parrot term. Because, I mean, it's not parroting like that, right? If you have a parrot and you train it, it repeats exactly what you say if you train it well. I've never done that, but I assume that's how it works. And here it says it's a stochastic parrot, so it's not exactly saying what you say. It's saying something similar, but what it says is actually original. Mm-hmm. And that's there's a lot of challenges arising from that. It's original content. It's also not plagiarism or something like that, because it's always original. But I'm not a fan of the stochastic parrot term. But there's a lot to it. Yeah, it's stochastic answers.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Maybe we can talk now a bit also on the negative things. You already said it, misinformation. So science communication, I think it's one part where you really need to provide facts, like it should be neutral, it should be accurate, it should be scientifical, proven information. And ChatGPT sometimes, maybe, as we said before, does not know the context. Maybe it does not even give you facts. It can create misinformation, fake news, pseudoscience, and even like deepfakes, so like on purpose something which is not very good. So do you know, are these the limits? So how do we recognize if this is now a good information, proven scientific information when we use AI, or is it just misinformation?
It's a difficult question. That is indeed one of the challenges. It's a challenge of science communication in general, not just related to generative AI, because sometimes even scientists sometimes say things that are not fully true or that they don't fully know about. So measuring generative AI against a 100% correct ground truth is not probably the right comparison. And the question also is, but maybe we don't have to get into that, well, what is the 100% correct ground truth in science? But anyway, it's a challenge, yes. The studies that we have, and many of the studies actually come from medical science, show that certainly on established issues where there's a high consensus in the scientific field, ChatGPT and other forms of generative AI give you really good answers. Answers that can compete with professionals, with scientists, essentially. So there's a number of studies that show on cancer misinformation, on identifying myths about Alzheimer's disease, etc. ChatGPT is really doing a good job. Much less so when it comes to current science, to things that have just come up, because there's very little training data available on them. So there it's often getting more challenging. And like the end point, the end game that's often discussed then is deepfakes, of course, which is in the field of science communication will also play a role. Maybe in political and other forms of communication, it will be even more problematic if it comes to that. But deepfakes where individual people, where personas are actually simulated with AI, their voices, their appearances, you can do videos, etc., that are hard to distinguish from actual information. And that is, it's going to be challenging to discover that. And do the usual tools apply? You need a human in the loop. You need somebody who can actually judge it. You should look for different sources. You should check for, right now, if it's audiovisual content, there are certain markers that you can still find, like the infamous, okay, Donald Trump has six fingers on this picture. Maybe it's not an accurate representation, etc. But that will get better. And that will, these glitches, or many of these glitches, will disappear. There's another issue on misinformation, disinformation, that is probably, is much less talked about, but probably as important, which is, and a colleague has called this dissolution of the knowledge pool. ChatGPT and other forms of AI are trained on digital training data and will be in the future. But the digital training data that they will use in the future will, to more and more, to an increasing intent, be generated by AI already. So it will be approximated content that is then used to train future AI. So there's a study came out a couple of weeks ago looking at Wikipedia article. Wikipedia is the go-to source for many people training AI, or one of the go-to sources, mm-hmm. because it's accurate and fairly reliable and open and accessible. And 5% of all Wikipedia articles created in 2024 contain considerable amounts of generative AI content. So that's where the cat starts eating its tail, in a way. And that is not blatant misinformation or blatant deepfakes or something like that. That's a gradual erosion of the quality of knowledge that we have. And that is also an important aspect that gets much less attention than the high profile, okay, we can simulate high level politicians or scientists and have them say other things.
So where is the human in that? So I'm just thinking, if AI is training itself, where does it left us?
AI is not training itself. Very much not so. It's AI is being fed vast amounts of digital data. Mm-hmm. And if you only do that, then AI is learning a lot of problematic content as well. And mm-hmm. there have been in the past. I mean, chatbots have been around since the 50s and 60s. And in 2016, for example, there was a high-profile example of a chatbot, Tay, being implemented on Twitter and essentially being rolled out there. It was not on Science Communication. And within hours, within a day, they had to take it down because it was turned into an right-wing, extremist, sexist bot by the users that were interacting with it. And what ChatGPT and its competitors have done much better is the extent and the kind of training. So there's extensive human training in there, and there's a lot of things by now that are really difficult to tease out of ChatGPT. It's really difficult to have it be, and not that I would want to, but it's really difficult to have it be discriminatory or sexist or climate skepticism, or to get something like that out of ChatGPT is really difficult. And this has nothing to do with this not being present in the training data. There's a lot of that stuff in the training data. It's been trained out. And now you can say, well, okay, there's no climate skepticism. Good thing. Maybe in that case, but the challenge is still, well, the decisions about what's good to have in there and what's not good to have in there is being made by a company. Mm-hmm. And you can agree with that or you cannot agree with that, but it's OpenAI and its competitors, not just OpenAI, it's just a prime example, and ChatGPT is the main LLM that people are using. There's a discussion to be had about the question, well, should it be companies deciding that? And there is a discussion, actually, for example, in more conservative and right circles in the US, where the impression is, and to some degree rightly so, well, these are liberal models, right? These mm-hmm. are models that come with certain values, and the values are embedded in the training, and they lead to certain things not being present in the answers. And we may like that to some degree on the things that we agree with that, but if we don't agree with that, we don't have to like that. And there will be other models coming for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's also like with the language development, there's also studies, you can see that language itself is changing because people who programmed or who like did the training data had another English than people from the US, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
We are talking here in this podcast about higher education, and like higher education, we always have to communicate. So education basically is communicating. We now do often use AI to support us in our education, like in our teaching, but also in the communication. What do you think? What are the risks there? We talked a lot about risk already. So is there something we need to pay special attention in higher education?
I think some of the risks apply in higher education that apply to other fields as well. So the errors that you get and the hallucinations that you get and generally the accuracy of what you get is certainly important. And if we're talking about higher education, it's often about science-related issues and you really have to be accurate there. And if you're not, it's a problem. So that is certainly something we have to look at here. We have to look at that in other fields as well, but certainly also here. The other thing we talked about is are biases. Generative AI in general is approximating patterns it finds in the training data. So the question is, okay, how does the training data look like? And the training data has certain characteristics, most likely. We don't know exactly how it looks like, but most likely it's rather English. It's more on the natural sciences, for example, if we look at our field. It's coming from Western countries. It's representing male perspectives more than other perspectives. It's generally representing more majority perspectives than minority perspectives, et cetera, et cetera. And all of that somehow translates into replies now or answers that generative AI is giving you. And we have to be wary of that. So what is actually coming out here, what are the biases, and it's very difficult to do that because there's no transparency about the big models don't give us the transparency usually. So what we can do and what we try to do, for example, is to reverse engineer that. So to actually, in our case, interview large language models to figure out, well, how do they actually understand things like science, or do they have a take on something like the reproducibility crisis or on astrology? And then try to figure out, well, what seems to be in there, what's their understanding of certain things. So that's the second thing, biases. Mainstreaming, I think, is another thing. It's easy to use these large language models. And if you use them in a very simple way, you get the most likely answer. And the most likely answer is often also not the most exciting answer or the most out-of-the-box answer. It's the mainstream boring answer often. So if you want to be creative, if you want to be innovative, if you want to be original, you have to know how to use it, and you have to play around with that in the right way. And that is certainly something that needs practice, and it needs experience, and it needs playing around with the tools to actually get a better sense. And it also needs training and education, of course, in these aspects. And maybe the last point is inequalities and divides that come with using that. And it can be individual. There's already studies showing, and that's true not only for generative AI, that has been true for other digital and other technological innovations. Certain people are able to use these things better or better versions or faster or earlier or in ways that benefits them more. And the question is, well, is there a divide emerging, or is there a gap widening between people who use them better and quicker and more fruitful than others? So that's a thing. And the same thing exists in on the level of organizations also. So can Western universities use better models than other universities? Can rich or larger or Swiss universities, because we are very resourced, we are very, very well resourced, can we use that better than universities in Peru or in Uganda or in Asian countries? And the same divides potentially exist between organizations. So different kinds of research organizations or different kinds of universities potentially can use these tools in different ways because they have a more or less money or more or less access to different things. So large universities may use them better and more fruitful than smaller universities potentially, or universities from rich countries may have more opportunities to use them than universities in less rich countries, et cetera, et cetera. So there may be differences between Swiss universities and Ugandan universities and Peruvian universities and others.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. So thank you for sharing this also with us, so these different perspectives. You said in an essay of the Journal of Science Communication that there is not enough research on what is going on in AI and science communication. So I was wondering what exactly should be researched more. You already shared something you were doing. So is there anything else?
Everything. No, I think the in general, if you look at science communication research in past years before 2022, there was very little about science communication in relation to AI. So how can we use AI in science communication, et cetera? And this has taken up in the last 2 years, of course. Now it's an important issue, and a lot of researchers also in our field have been taking that up and are doing very good. We had a big conference in Zurich in June, and there was a lot of really fascinating research coming in then. And you see that. So there's more and more publications. I think in this essay, the notorious GPT thing that I wrote there, I try to boil it down to four areas that I think we need research on. One is, I called it their communication about AI. And that is similar to science communication or communication about other technological innovations as well. So about smartphones, about social media, about the web as such. There were many instances with new technologies came up, and the question was, well, how are they taken up in society? And how does society also shape the uptake of this of these technologies. And the same thing we need about AI. So questions there would be, well, who's trying to push AI? What are the imaginaries, the visions of AI that you find in different countries? How do public debates about AI and the risks and the benefits look like, et cetera, et cetera? Who's using that? What effects does it have? That's very classical science communication in a way. What's new or newer is communication with AI, which is also an important aspect, where AI actually becomes an agent or has some agency, at least, in science communication, where it's a communication partner, where it's perceived as a communication partner, where it's about questions of, well, how does AI actually represent certain scientific issues? How does it interact with people who agree or not agree with different kinds of positions towards science? So that's certainly an interesting aspect that interests me a lot. The third aspect is AI will have an impact on the science communication ecosystem, I think. So on the landscape of science communication. I already mentioned that. We also discussed aspects of that. Science communication in organizations has changed and will likely change due to AI. The question of, well, does it replace? Does AI replace communicators, or to what degree, or does it complement them, and how do jobs of science communicators look like potentially in 10 years? What does AI do to science journalism, etc.? These are questions that are really interesting and will be fascinating to see over the next years, because AI will change the landscape on a bigger level. And the fourth area is methodologically and conceptually, we have to rethink what we are doing in times of AI. Many of the concepts that we have don't really work when one of the communication partners is an AI. And also methodologically, the question that we can use this in many, many ways. And many colleagues are testing AI in terms of, well, can AI be an interviewer for qualitative interviews when we do a lot of qualitative interviews? Or can AI approximate, simulate something like surveys and survey results? So could we have it interface with surveys, etc.? Can we use it for analysis, etc.? And it's used in many ways, and often we are not at the point where we can actually use it already, but we are certainly at the point where we are testing it out and testing its validity and reliability. And the question, well, how useful is it actually? And there will be a lot of uses there.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Also, like for other social sciences, of course, when it comes to questionnaires and the stakeholder group, if an AI can kind of simulate the population you want to ask questionnaires,
There's an interesting study, for example, where people have tried to use different large language models with different prompts to approximate attitudes towards science of the US population. And depending on the model and the prompt, you could get up to 91% accuracy of simulating the population, which is good. And also, it went down to below 50% for some of the prompts, so it wasn't always good. But in some, it was really good. But it significantly underestimated minorities also. So mm-hmm. the opinions of Black Americans, for example, were significantly underestimated. And that's going back to the biases that we discussed earlier. It's okay-ish on the general level, but it has clear limitations and biases. And you have to be aware of that and you have to see them.
So, yeah, thank you very much. So we are a podcast here about the future of higher education, and we are allowed to dream a bit as well. So I would like to ask you, what do you think? What would be your dream? How is the future of science communication? How would it look like in, let's say, 10 years?
That's a good question. In relation to AI?
Yeah.
I mean, I think what I would really like, and there's some potential in generative AI, but there's also, as I said, a lot of bots, is this scaling up of dialogue. So science communication, if you do it to the broader public, has a lot of different, very different target groups, potentially. And we tried for Switzerland, for example, we do what's called the Science Barometer Switzerland, the Wissenschaftsbarometer Schweiz, where we regularly assess what the Swiss think about science. And we also use this to identify typical groups among the Swiss population in terms of how they look at science. And then you find, for example, what we have called the science files, people very interested and very knowledgeable about science. And they are the ones that already have a lot of information about science, that also find a lot of information because they seek out online media. They use a lot of media. They use media in different languages, in English often, certainly. And they have a lot of information that's available to them. But there's other groups and larger groups, more importantly, that are not that easy to reach because they themselves aren't seeking out science-related topics. And they are more difficult, for example, to get into a university or into a museum or elsewhere. And the question is, well, how do you reach them? And how do you reach them in a way that interests them or that really makes a difference for how they see science? And what many colleagues say then is, well, dialogue is important. If you get them, you have to engage with them and you have to have a dialogue with them. And this also has been shown to be pretty effective, but it's very, very time and resource intensive. You can't have 500 dialogues with people in a month or something like that. So on the one hand, this dialogue format is like many consider it a great way to do science communication, but it's difficult to scale up. And now the question is, okay, what could generative AI do here? And could it really be useful to scale up this dialogical component? And there's certainly the potential in there. There's also a lot of challenges to navigate and to circumvent there, but the potential is certainly there. That I would really like.
Thank you so much. Thank you for this really exciting talk, I think. And thank you, listeners, to listen to our podcast today. This was the last episode of this season, Setting Sails, Navigating AI in Higher Education. My name is Alexandra Jansky, and this is a podcast from Educational Development Team at the University of Zurich and LernNetz, a company that drives innovation in education. We really hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you did, please subscribe and send us feedback, ideas, questions, and topics you are interested in to teachingtools@education.ush.ch. You will find all this information in the show notes. Have a wonderful time and stay well.